Police employ many tactics to solve cases through continued training and implementing new techniques, learning from prior experience, thinking outside the box, or employing a ruse. The list goes on and on. But sometimes a case can be tough to crack. It stalls and goes nowhere. And in those situations, all it takes is a little extra help from an anonymous tip to get the ball rolling again. That was the story in Northern California after several women went missing during the 1980s. Over a period of 2 years, a tip line offering rewards for information received at least 35 calls, which led to the bodies of 3 different victims. But those calls weren't just lucky tips coming from the public. They were all made by one man.
Police began to notice a pattern between the incoming calls and the missing woman. And while this particular tip line proved invaluable in today's case, it also became the detective's biggest roadblock when trying to identify the killer. Today, we're covering the case of the tipster killer. I'm Em, a former special agent.
And I'm Katie Kaplan, an investigative journalist, and you're listening to Two Sleuths.
Warning, this podcast contains graphic content that may not be suitable for all listeners. All suspects or persons of interest discussed on this podcast are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Listener discretion advised.
It was Memorial Day weekend of 1985. 48-year-old Avril Whedon was nowhere to be found. Her mother, Eula Chartier, had been trying to reach her for days. Avril owned a home in northern central California, in the town of Redding, only about 20 miles north of where her mother and brother lived in Shasta County. She lived alone, but to make some extra cash, she rented out one of the rooms in her house. Eula had been trying to reach Avril for several days leading up to that holiday weekend. She kept calling the house, hoping someone would answer. Finally, Avril's roommate, 28-year-old Robert Murray, picked up the phone. When she asked to speak to her daughter, Robert only told her that Avril was fine, but she wasn't home at the moment because she had just ran out to the store. Now, this put Eula at ease for the time being, but when she called back later, Avril still hadn't returned. Becoming concerned, she pressed the roommate for more information. But Robert responded, "How the hell am I supposed to know where she is?"
It was his landlord after all, so I suppose that he had a point. But after that conversation, he stopped answering the phone altogether. So Eula decided to drive to the house and figure out just what was going on. When she arrived, she noticed that Avril's mustard-colored pickup truck was gone, and Avril wasn't inside the house either. But Robert was, and the story was now that Avril had left for vacation with a friend, but of course, he had no idea where to. At this point, her family was starting to panic. Avril's brother, Bill, started reaching out to friends and acquaintances. One of them was a guy named Ray Morris, who was also a friend of Robert's. Bill had met him one night while hanging out at Avril's house. And Ray told him that the last time he saw Avril, she was leaving the house with Robert on the back of his motorcycle.
As Robert hadn't mentioned this to her family, Bill confronted Robert with this new information. But he only went on to continue to explain Avril's absence with different and conflicting stories every time. It wasn't long before Avril's family filed a missing persons report on her. And by the first week of June, police were knocking on her door and interviewing Robert. Detective Dave Mundy of the Redding Police Department was assigned the case. He noted that Robert was very relaxed despite the unannounced arrival. Robert was described as remaining self-assured during the interview and denied having anything to do with his landlord's disappearance. He told the detective that the last time he had seen her was sometime the week before. But he couldn't remember the exact day, that Memorial Day weekend. It was either Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. And that was about as specific as he could get.
Now, Detective Mundy wanted the details of what their last interaction was like, so he kept pressing Robert. And Robert said he had taken Avril on his motorcycle to a telephone booth because she needed to make a call. He had dropped her off there and then went to run an errand for her. He told police that Avril had wanted him to pick up some drugs nearby. Robert said he did that and then went back to pick Avril up from the phone booth and they rode back together to the house, but after that, he hadn't seen her. Now, this version was another version yet different from what he had told Avril's brother, Bill, so Detective Mundy went back to interview Robert about a week later. But Robert repeated the same story, and Detective Mundy didn't have much more to go on, so he kept Robert in mind as a person of interest. There were no other leads in the case, so the detective decided to advertise Avril's disappearance with something called the Secret Witness Program.
Now, the Secret Witness Program had been established in Shasta County about 10 years prior by a group of Soroptimists, a woman's organization that was founded back in 1921. They wanted a way to help law enforcement as they investigated local crimes. The program offered rewards in exchange for information that helped to solve any open cases, and the public was assured that the reporting party could remain anonymous. Police would then coordinate with this group on which crimes they were looking for leads on, and then the Secret Witness Advisory Board would decide on how much money to offer for the information on each case. These rewards were then publicized in newspapers, as well as TV and radio ads.
When the program started, they hired a woman named Shirley Landreth, who owned an answering service to field the calls. When someone called in with a tip, they were instructed to come up with a code for themselves containing three letters and three numbers. This code would allow the tipster to remain anonymous and eventually be paid out. Shirley ran the program smoothly and had more than a decade of experience under her belt with it when she got a call on June 19th of 1985. The caller was a man with a distinctive voice, and he wanted to know how much they would pay for information that led police to a body. And Shirley told him she was just the answering service, so she would have to take that information to the advisory board, who would then decide.
Several weeks later, the Secret Witness hotline rang again. It was August 8th, and Shirley instantly recognized the caller's voice. She would later say it stood out because of the speed of his speech and the pushiness of it, the way he grouped certain words together, as well as the abrupt way he would terminate their conversations. This time, the man asked if the board had come up with a reward price. Shirley relayed that the amount was somewhere between $250 to $500 for that information. With inflation today, that's about $750 to $1,500. Apparently, this was agreeable to him because he then started describing an area in South Reading, and he gave detailed instructions on where a woman's body could be found. Shirley noted that the caller measured the distance in meters, which obviously isn't the standard unit of measurement here in the United States.
Now, before hanging up, the man upped the ante, and he said the woman had been murdered, and he would also provide the killer's name if he was paid quickly. And just before he ended the conversation, he also mentioned that he knew information that could help solve two of the county's six unsolved homicides. After the call, Shirley contacted the police and relayed the information the caller had provided. Detectives headed out. It was a field in South Reading, which was just off Interstate 5. And sure enough, they found a body. It had been obscured with a piece of cardboard and part of what looked like an old carpet. And it had clearly been out there for some time because it was pretty badly decomposed.
It was several weeks before the autopsy results came back. And when they did, the victim's identity was confirmed to be Avril Whedon. She had been missing for about 2.5 months at this point. During the autopsy, two traumatic injuries were found that shed some light on her death. One was a fracture in her skull, and the other was a broken hyoid bone in her neck. The medical examiner determined that both were significant enough to have independently caused her death, but they noted that the damage to the hyoid bone was consistent with strangulation. Detective Mundy's disappearance was now a homicide. Luckily, the Secret Witness Program continued to pay off as more leads on her case started trickling in.
After Avril's body was found, the same man called back. In fact, he called the Secret Witness Program 4 times in 1 day. He again told Shirley that he knew who killed Avril, and he pointed the finger at her roommate. Shirley asked him if he would be willing to speak to the detective on the case, but he refused. However, he said that if the police wanted to provide a list of questions, he would be willing to call back and answer them, but he would only provide the information to her.
A few days later, he called again, and Shirley was ready and waiting. Detective Mundy had prepared a list of questions, and first on the list was, "What is the name of Avril's killer?" The man said his name was either Bob or Robert, and that he rented a room from Avril. When she asked how he knew this, the caller said that he provided drugs to Robert. And one time, Robert had brought up his roommate, Averill, saying he was trying to score some drugs on her behalf. The caller said that he ended up giving Robert those drugs, but later, when he went to the house to collect payment, Averill didn't have the money. The caller said that was when he watched Robert fly into a rage. He grabbed a nylon clothesline out of the backyard and strangled her.
Another question on the list was, if the killer denies murdering her, how can we nail him? The caller told Shirley that they should tell Bob that Dave has talked to Frank and that will scare the shit out of him. He then abruptly hung up. But before the police could move on this information, the man called back. Shirley was ready with more questions from detectives. This time, he had a different version of events. He said that when he went to their house to collect payment, Averill and Bob had left their house on his motorcycle, and that he had followed them in his car out to a fairly abandoned trail. It was at this spot that Bob had strangled Averill before he dragged her body to where it was eventually found. The caller added that once she was dumped, Bob had grabbed a rock and hit her over the head to make sure that she was dead, and then he covered her body with leaves and branches.
The caller said Bob went back later and covered her body with other items, like possibly a blanket or a rug. Another question from police was what had happened with the clothesline that had been used to strangle Averill. The man said that it could be found in a shed in Averill's backyard. And when describing the locations, he again used meters instead of feet as a unit of measurement. Police also wanted to know when this had all transpired. And so when Shirley asked the caller, he said he remembered that this all went down on a Thursday night. And the reason he could remember this is because it was the same day as one of his relatives' birthdays. After this call, Shirley had a ton of new information to pass along to Detective Mundy.
At this point, it was about a month after Averill's body had been found and roughly 3 months after she had gone missing. And during all this time, Robert was still living in her home. Armed with this new information from the caller, Detective Mundy headed over for another interview. But again, Robert did not waver. He repeated the exact same story he had told the detective during the first and second interviews. They rode to the payphone, he picked up some drugs, and then they came back to the house together, and he never saw her again after that. The detective again asked him what day this all took place, and this time, Robert remembered it as a Friday because his nephew's birthday party had been the next afternoon. Not surprisingly, this last bit of information stuck out because it was eerily similar to what the caller had told Shirley, remembering the date of the murder based off of a relative's birthday. Was it a coincidence? Or was Robert actually the killer and had named himself as such?
At this point, Robert had moved from person of interest to a pretty solid suspect. No matter who the caller was, he seemed to have provided accurate information about Averill's murder that hadn't been made public. However, the case against Robert was only circumstantial. Even though the secret witness program had been passing information along to police and allowing the detective to ask questions of the caller through the program, this was only because the caller consented to that. But that was as far as the program would go. And since the caller had chosen to remain anonymous, the police weren't going to be able to use them in court. And this left a case that had started to heat up turn cold again. No new information came in regarding Averill's case for over a month. Until the phone rang. This time, it was a phone at the Shasta County Sheriff's Office.
Robert Murray wanted to speak with a detective. He had gotten into some trouble and wanted to work out a deal. He told the investigator that he had been charged with possession of stolen property, but he had information on a homicide case that was being investigated by the Reading PD. He offered information stating that he knew the victim had died via strangulation and had also been hit in the head with a rock, and that he would offer more information as long as he could receive immunity in the Averill Whedon case. The detective said he might be able to help with stolen property charges, but he'd need to check about the immunity. The detective then called Reading PD and got in touch with Detective Mundy and briefed him on the conversation.
After learning this, Detective Mundy just called Robert himself, and Robert confirmed that yes, he was willing to talk, but only if he was given immunity. But as you sleuths know, only a prosecutor can offer immunity. So the DA and Detective Mundy set up a meeting with Robert to hear more about what he allegedly knew. They all sat down in Averill's house so Robert could prove he had information that would help them with the case. Now, it isn't clear if Robert was just in a chatty mood or if he was asked to provide something in good faith before the deal was finalized. But he did more than provide just a little information. He talked and talked. And here is the story he told them, keeping in mind there was no deal for immunity on the table.
Robert said he came home one day to find his friend Ray Morris assaulting Averill. Morris was on top of her with a rope wrapped around her neck, but he immediately jumped off and let go of the rope when he noticed Robert had walked into the room. And Robert told investigators it was too late at this point. Averill was already dead. As he stood there in shock, Robert said a second guy, someone he didn't know, came into the room and immediately pulled out a gun. The stranger pointed it directly at Robert and he froze. Then Morris used the rope that had been around Averill's neck to tie his hands together. Robert watched as Morris and the second man loaded Averill's body into the back of her own pickup truck. Then they forced him in beside her.
Robert said that the guys drove the truck out to an area with a trail, and then they unloaded her body. He then watched as Morris threw rocks at Averill. Then he turned his attention back to Robert. At this point, Robert said he feared for his life and was convinced that they were going to shoot him and leave him out there too. He said he begged for his life and told them he would do anything they wanted. Morris threatened him then, telling Robert that if he went to the police, that Morris would find out and kill him. When Robert was done talking, Detective Morris and the DA left the house. And again, Robert had laid out this entire version of events without ever having been granted immunity.
The investigators went back about 2 weeks later, and this time Robert had a similar story, but some of the details were different. During this retelling, he said he wasn't 100% sure that Averill was actually dead by the time they got to the trail. And he added something else that was new. He told the prosecutors that when they were out by the trail, Morris held him at gunpoint and forced him to hit Averill over the head with a large rock. Morris had allegedly said he hoped hitting her with rocks would confuse police so they wouldn't know how she died. As he was talking, Robert began to describe the location in detail. And then he said something that made Detective Mundy's ears perk. Robert mentioned the distance of something in meters. Shirley with the Secret Witness Answering Service had already provided the detective with some details about the man who kept calling the tip line, and she had specifically mentioned the unusual way he referred to distance in terms of meters. So right then and there, Detective Mundy confronted Robert about being the caller who led police to Averill's body. But Robert denied that he had ever called the hotline.
Detective Mundy now had two unique pieces of information to link Robert and the secret witness tipster: the use of the metric system to measure distance and the reference of a relative's birthday to remember what day Averill had been murdered. However, these two things alone weren't concrete proof that Robert was in fact the caller. Detective Mundy reached out to the advisory board of the secret witness program to see if they would assist him in identifying the caller. He tried to explain his case and how if they helped him identify the caller the next time he called in, that it would solve this murder. He knew it would be a long shot, and sure enough, they declined to help him, citing the ethical guideline, which prohibited them from identifying their tipsters. While Robert had become the prime suspect in Averill's homicide, everything investigators had was circumstantial, and it just wasn't enough for the DA to move forward with charges against Robert.
So about a year passed without any movement on the case or calls into the secret witness program from the strange man. It was the end of 1986 when the phone to the hotline rang and Shirley answered. It was completely out of the blue, but she recognized the voice right away. This time, the caller wanted to know what the reward would be for information on an unsolved burglary case. She once again explained that the advisory board would have to decide and told him she would ask and that he should call back. It was about a week before he called again, but instead of the burglary, he brought up the Averill Whedon case. He told Shirley that he wanted immunity in exchange for more information. And then he did something unexpected, and he told Shirley his name. As detectives had suspected, it was Robert Murray. However, she couldn't confirm this to detectives because the program was based on anonymity. Shirley, of course, had nothing to do with granting immunity, and she explained that to Robert. He ended the call by hanging up.
Sometime in the aftermath of Averill's death, Robert had started working with the Reading Police Department, but in a completely different capacity. He was working as a paid informant for a robbery case that they were working on. This case ended up going to trial, and during the process, Robert's name was leaked to the public, identifying him as a police informant. When Robert learned this, he flew off the handle, believing that he was outed by the police themselves. He called Detective Mundy to tell him just what he thought about it, and as he was giving the detective an earful, he took a jab, telling the detective that he would take the details of Averill's death to the grave, and they would never learn what really happened to her. Then, that spring, more women started disappearing.
Three local women, who all had similar physical traits, vanished in quick succession. The first was 28-year-old Gretchen Olsten, who was 5'4", about 105 pounds, with blonde hair and green eyes. She lived on a ranch in the little town of Oak Run, about 20 miles east of Reading. She disappeared in late March of 1987. Her neighbors were the last people to see her, and they later told police that her boyfriend had told them she had stormed off after a fight in the middle of the night and never returned.
The clues police would develop throughout Gretchen's investigation proved to be alarming. By early June, the detectives on the case told newspaper reporters that they suspected her disappearance was tied to foul play. During the course of the investigation, police had learned about a trailer she and her ex-boyfriend would sometimes stay in. It was located on a different ranch, about 6 miles away. When police found it, they also found some of Gretchen's personal belongings that indicated she had been staying there after the fight. However, she was nowhere to be found.
And those personal items included some of her clothes and her two dogs. They had been left alone, which obviously wasn't a good sign. Then her car was found about 3 miles away, parked in a residential neighborhood, and her purse was inside. Police conducted elaborate searches, including using divers to check several ponds, using a tractor to move a dump site that was thought could conceal a body, as well as aerial searches. Luckily for the man who owned the ranch, he had a solid alibi. He was out of town, and the newspapers didn't state why, but they never suspected her boyfriend as taking part in her disappearance.
Then in late June, 20-year-old Dawn Berryhill went missing. She was also a petite woman, only 5'2", 100 pounds, and she had shoulder-length, dirty blonde hair. She was also a brand new mother, with a 6-week-old newborn son to care for. She and her boyfriend were living together in an apartment in Reading. On the morning of June 22nd, she kicked her boyfriend, Mike, out of the apartment. Then she called her mom, Diane. She asked if she could come over to babysit while Dawn went out and searched for a new apartment. While she was gone, her mother answered 2 phone calls, both from a guy who said his name was Bob. He asked if Dawn was still with her boyfriend, and when Diane told him no, he said, "Good, because I have a place she can rent." But then he elaborated by saying he wouldn't rent to her if she was still with her boyfriend.
A little later, Diane took the baby to the nearby park, and as she walked up, she spotted Dawn talking to a guy on a motorcycle. When the conversation ended, Dawn walked over to her mother and the baby, and the three of them headed back home. On the way, Diane mentioned that a man named Bob had called twice, and Dawn said that was the guy she was just talking to near the park. Dawn told her mom that they had actually made plans to hang out that night. They were going to head to someone's house named Big Mama to pick up some pot. Once they got back to the apartment, Diane said goodbye and left. It was the last time she would ever see her daughter.
It was around 9 p.m. that night when Dawn knocked on her neighbor's door, asking for a ride. The neighbor explained that the headlights on her car were broken, and so she couldn't do it, but she did offer to babysit for Dawn if she was able to find another ride. Dawn told her she knew of a guy who hung out at the liquor store just across the street, and he drove a motorcycle and was probably willing to do it. Dawn left her baby with the neighbor and promised to be back in about 30 minutes. Dawn headed out, crossed the street, and approached Bob on his bike. But as she was talking to him, her now ex-boyfriend, Mike, had arrived with one of his buddies. They were there to collect Mike's belongings.
Mike would later tell police that he had walked over and talked to Dawn and the guy on the bike. They had chatted for a moment before Dawn left. The last time anyone saw Dawn, she was on the back of a stranger's motorcycle. Hours passed by, and the neighbor who was watching her son grew more worried with each passing second. But sadly, Dawn never returned for her son.
The third disappearance to happen that summer was of Belinda Jo Stark. The 30-year-old was a bit of a free spirit. She didn't have a permanent address and preferred to bounce around. often staying with friends. It was only a few days after Dawn was last seen that Belinda Jo also disappeared. At that time, she had been staying with a friend, and she showed this friend a chrome-plated gun that she was carrying in her purse. The next day, Belinda told her boyfriend that she was leaving for Nevada to take care of some traffic tickets out there. She had a court date scheduled in just a few days and believed she was probably going to have to serve a little time in jail. So when a few weeks turned into a few months, no one was overly worried that Belinda hadn't made contact. She was planning to serve some time, and it was also a pretty common pattern not to hear from her for a while with her come-and-go lifestyle. And because of this, Belinda Jo wasn't even reported missing.
By the beginning of August of 1987, Shirley, who was still answering for the secret witness program, got a call from a voice she hadn't heard in a while, but immediately recognized. This time, the caller wanted to know what they would pay if he told them where Gretchen Olsten's body was. She had been missing for 5 months at this point. Per the usual, Shirley told him she would have to take the information to the board and ask, and that he could call back to find out. When he did, about 10 days later, he had two stipulations that he wanted to be met before he would give directions to Gretchen's body. He wanted to be paid on the same day, and he wanted to be paid before they confirmed the identity of the victim. These conditions were agreed upon, and Shirley guaranteed him a $500 check for the information. The man then provided specific directions down a dusty trail to a sort of wooded area in a place called Happy Valley, just outside of Redding.
Police headed out to canvass the area, but there was nothing there. A few hours later, the caller phoned again, this time to schedule the reward pickup, but Shirley broke the news that police didn't find anything in the area he directed the police to. The cops had told Shirley that the directions led them to a road that had a power line on it, and when Shirley told this to the caller, he said they were on the wrong road, and so he gave the directions again. He then said he would provide the name of the person who killed Gretchen if they left the money for him that day. It was agreed that the money would be dropped off at a title company. He told Shirley that when he picked up the cash, he would leave an envelope with the killer's name. However, right before he hung up, the man said that it was Gretchen's boyfriend who had killed her.
Despite that information, the secret witness program decided to move forward with the plan, and someone left the $500 for the caller at the title company. They waited a few hours, and then they returned to pick up the envelope that was supposed to have the killer's name. However, when they retrieved it, they found the envelope was empty. Despite this, the program still handed it over to the police as evidence. Now, while this exchange had been going on, detectives had gone back to search the new area they had been directed to, and they had found skeletonized remains. They could tell immediately it was a female, but because of the condition of the body, it would take some time to identify her. About 130 yards away, police found a blanket and entered it into evidence. After the autopsy, it was concluded that the woman had been sexually assaulted. While they couldn't determine the exact cause of death, it was recorded as unnatural, with notes about how she had obtained blunt force trauma to the upper jaw at the time of her death. The impact was so strong it had knocked one of her teeth out. Eventually, she would be positively identified, but not as Gretchen Olsten. Instead, as the free-spirited Belinda Jo Stark, no one even knew she was missing.
The murder investigation into Belinda was now in full force, and it obviously bared a lot of similarities to the discovery of Avril Wheaton's body 2 years earlier, and Avril's case was still unsolved. Luckily for police, Shirley with the answering service was a smart woman, and she told Detective Mundy that this most recent tip was the same repeat caller who had eventually led them to Avril's body. At this point, Shirley was highly suspicious, and so she went against the secret witness program rules and decided to record the caller's voice for just a few seconds.
Police were already suspicious of Robert. He was the prime suspect in Avril's case. He had been living with her, he was the last person seen with her, and his story had changed. Now they wondered if he could be the caller.
And recently, police noticed that Robert's name had been popping up even more. In fact, someone had just filed a police report against him, stemming from something that occurred a couple months prior. The victim survived, and so for her protection, we will call her Amy. On June 20th, just 2 days before Dawn Berryhill went missing, Amy met Robert out and about, and they started chatting. She was heading to a friend's house, and Robert offered to give her a ride on the back of his motorcycle. She agreed and hopped on the back of his bike. He then dropped her off at the friend's house, and she thanked him before she turned and headed into the house. She hung out with her friend for a while before heading back to her own residence. A few hours later, she walked out the front door. She had plans to head to a local fair that night. And as she looked down the street, she saw something startling. It was the man with the motorcycle parked on her street.
This was unnerving for Amy because she had never told him where she lived. It became clear to her that he had waited outside of her friend's house for hours and then followed her home. She was apprehensive, and when he saw her, he pulled up to her. But as they got to talking, she was disarmed. He said he was headed to a big party his friend was throwing out on a bike trail in Happy Valley, and he invited her to come along. She thought it sounded like a good time, so she agreed and hopped on the back of his bike. They headed out, driving down different trails, and ended up in a clearing near some brush and overgrowth. There wasn't a soul around, and she said she quickly realized that there was no party. Amy asked Robert to take her home, but he assured her his friends would be here any minute.
But Amy knew something was wrong, and the longer they waited, the more convinced she became that this man was going to kill her. And so she very slyly removed her driver's license from her purse and put it in her back pocket. She wanted to make sure that she would be identified by police. While her attention was shifted away from him, Robert came up and slid a rope around her neck. It had been fashioned into a slipknot, and he pulled it tight and then ordered her to remove her clothes and lie down. She complied, and then he raped her. Afterward, he drove her home. She later told police that at this point, she didn't know his name, and maybe that is why he let her live. It would be just 2 days later that Dawn Berryhill went missing.
Needless to say, Amy was terrified after what happened, but she didn't feel she had anyone to turn to, so she kept the assault to herself and did not file a report. But all of that changed when she met Gary Minoletti. They had started dating in the weeks after the assault, and eventually she trusted him enough to talk about the rape. A few weeks later, they were at a liquor store when Amy looked out the shop window and saw a man pull up on a motorcycle. She froze and panic took over. She pointed to the man and told Gary that was the man who had raped her. Gary went out to the parking lot and confronted him. The guy on the bike said his name was Robert Murray, and at one point while they were talking, he looked past Gary and saw Amy. Then he asked, "Is that Dawn?" When Gary told him it wasn't, Robert responded that she sure looked a lot like Dawn. It was almost as if he was taunting him because of the disappearance of Dawn Berryhill. The young mother, who had never returned to pick up her infant son a few weeks before, was a pretty high-profile case. It would be a sure thing that most people in the area had heard about her disappearance.
Gary wrote down the license plate number of Robert's motorcycle, and then he drove Amy straight to the police station to help her file a police report about the rape. Police finally had something to charge Robert Murray with. Police had plenty of circumstantial evidence pointing towards Robert for the murder of Avril and Belinda, but the DA didn't think it was enough. And because of the protocol surrounding the secret witness program and the protection it provides to its anonymous callers, Detective Mundy wasn't sure how to move forward with their cases. But a call 2 weeks later would change everything. And that is where we're going to leave you for today. But come back next week for the conclusion of the case of the tipster killer.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, please do us a favor and take a second to drop a rating in your podcast player. Then leave us a comment if you can. We may even shout you out in a future episode.
Today, we're going to shout out Michigan Honey, who said, quote, "I love hearing about the lesser unknown solved cases. I was actually drawn to your podcast because of the Battle Creek content. I'm 2 years younger than Patty Rozanski, and I lived 2 blocks away from her at the time of her murder. I also knew Maggie and her brother John. That was a scary time in Battle Creek for young ladies. I've never been convinced that Thomas Kress was Patty's murderer. I always felt that Carrie Evans' murder was neglected and lost in the shadows of other cases. Keep up the good work."
Michigan Honey, thank you so much for reaching out. Hearing your review tells us that these unsolved cases are getting to the right people in the right area. Someone somewhere knows something about every single case. This particular case, the Battle Creek murders, was a tragic one that is still unsolved. And if anyone listening has any information that can help move the investigation forward, please call the Battle Creek Police Department. We'll put that information in the show notes.
Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay vigilant.
And stay curious, fellow sleuths.